Dave Fanning on 2FM.
Now, social media claims to bring us all closer together thanks to Skype, mobile phones and Facebook. Keeping up with friends and family, whether they're on the other side of the world or just down the road, is easier than ever before. However, the flip side of that, argues author Susan Pinker, is that people are engaging from the comfort of their couches, but they're not getting out there and meeting other people face to face as much anymore. They're not as integrated in their neighbourhood or local community. Well, in her latest book called The Village Effect, Why Face-to-Face Contact Matters, Susan proposes that we need close social bonds and uninterrupted FaceTime with our friends and families in order to thrive and even, frankly, survive. And Susan is with us now. Susan, you're very welcome to the programme. First of all, explain the title of the book. What exactly is The Village Effect?
I use that term, The Village Effect, as a metaphor for the type of social contact that we all need to do well, to survive and thrive as human beings. Because not all social contact is created equal. For example, we know now from new evidence that people who gather together to have a coffee or to share gossip or play cards, if they do that regularly, they have a 2 to 15 year survival advantage over loners, people who, as you say, sit on their couch and tap out messages to their contacts.
Face-to-face contact is not just good for our mental health, but also it's vital for our physical health. Studies have found this. Are you sort of concentrating particularly on cancer in the book?
No, I'm not concentrating on cancer, but I do write about cancer in one of the early chapters because it's been so well researched. And especially breast cancer, I think it's probably the most researched disease that exists right now. And we know, for example, that women who have active breast cancer with large networks of friends and family have 4 times the likelihood of survival. And one of the reasons is because when they meet with people face to face, this unleashes a whole cascade of biological events that affects how they feel in the here and now. It gives them a sense of well-being. And it also affects how their cells react to other onslaughts or traumas. So we do know that, for example, social contact switches on and off genes that regulate tumor growth. It builds up your immunity. So it sounds kind of magical, but actually it's quite a concrete event.
Okay, well then, let's just take it broader and say, like, you know, as our online circle of friends gets bigger, you're saying the circle of close friends gets smaller, and modern living is eroding close-knit communities. Technology is very much a culprit. Is it that we haven't figured out how to yet measure our relationship to the internet?
If that is coming, and I would say that it's not just our close relationships with that have eroded, because we're now living in an age of loneliness. We have fewer people we can talk to. The research tells us that about 25 to 30% of people say that they feel lonely. And interestingly, the picture of loneliness is different in the UK than it is in North America. In North America, it's the middle-aged who are the loneliest. And in the UK, it's young adults, and say the recently retired around age 60, 65, who say they're very lonely. And so this is ramping up. It's increasing as we get more connected, as our devices increase, our loneliness is increasing. It doesn't mean that one causes the other, but I think it's one of the factors that comes into play. And so really, we have to really pay attention to the ways that our devices are eroding our opportunity to connect with people, not just the close relationships, but that middle layer, Dave, talking to our neighbors, talking to our colleagues, being in the here and now, just enjoying in the here and now the effect of eye contact, a little pat on the back, a fist bump, a handshake. All of these little actions fly under our radar, but they have a measurable effect.
Well, then also, in terms of parents towards kids, I mean, like 20 years ago, few people had phones, there were no emails, 10 years ago, no YouTube. It's the fact that parents don't necessarily understand this world, therefore they can't prepare the kids, if you like, for the world, and we're just throwing our kids into it. Now, some of the stuff that you come up with, like, is the girls aged 8 to 12, that they're more unhappy, those who text and update and instant message and all, than those who don't, and this is kind of found by, you know, surveys, etc. And by the age of 17, more than 70% of girls are bullied online, etc. Is it that, like, in general, you have to understand, if you're an adult, that teens feel social isolation much more than adults do?
Absolutely. You know, the human brain, and especially a teenager's brain, is built to connect socially face-to-face. That's how we learn to talk. That's how we learn to understand the intentions and emotions of other people. And what's important, you mentioned parents, is what's important to keep in mind about online connection is that you can monitor it and you could keep it in safe proportions for your teenagers. And if people keep in mind that, for example, if they consider it like the junk food of social interaction, they wouldn't allow their children at any age to eat chocolate bars or crisps three times a day. Yet they have often parents allow unlimited access to devices mm-hmm. all day long and increase it in the classroom as well. So it's not that it should be barred, but really, and certainly I'm not advocating that at all because it's very useful for lots of different reasons. But it's very important for teenagers to have the opportunity to connect in person with others and including with their parents, because as you may have learned in the book, texting has no impact, for example, on their ability to feel reassurance from the adults around them, to reduce their stress levels. So we have to look at electronic communication as useful but different.
Right. Okay. Oh, by the way, like the food analogy, let's take that to a different direction, because there's a strong correlation between social contact and food, which can have both a positive and negative impact on us. Isn't that what you're saying? Like sort of eating together is a form of social glue.
Very much. And I think from the beginnings of human civilization, meals were used to bond people together. And so it's very important that people realize that a meal is a great opportunity to put away your phone. A family meal, for example, is a great time to interact face-to-face with your kids. Because here's an important fact, Dave, that I hope your listeners will remember, is that there is nothing as predictive for school success and happiness as regular family meals. There are all sorts of reasons for this, but families who practice sitting down at least, you know, 3-4 times a week with their children and teenagers and just eating and chatting together have much better outcomes.
Okay, like by the way, we are talking to Susan Pinker, and the book is called The Village Effect: Why Face-to-Face Contact Matters. And Susan, you spent many years as a clinical psychologist. What would you say to somebody who might glibly say, oh yeah, right, the village effect, that's one of those popular sciences?
Yeah, I mean, I think that most of this information is new. I had never read it or heard of it, and I'm a psychologist, and I don't think anybody else has. Some of it feels like it has a common sense ring to it. Oh, yeah, you know, getting together at the pub regularly, that might be a good idea. But as our lives become more solitary, we don't really anticipate or realize the cumulative effect of loneliness, and that even people who are introverted, who are shy, need social contact. Because if we carry that analogy of food a bit further, it would be like saying, okay, well, you know, if you are a small person with a small appetite, you don't need to eat at all. Well, of course, that's ridiculous. And similarly, with social contact, if you're shy or introverted, you absolutely do need social contact face to face. The research shows that you're more likely to come down with colds and all sorts of viruses if you're more alone, because loneliness leaves a particular fingerprint on every cell of your body. So it's more a question of monitoring and adjusting when you have social contact, the type that is right for you, than just saying, no, it's much easier for me to just communicate by text and email.
Well, then on that point of solitary lives, I mean, loneliness is something that you talk about a lot in your book, but loneliness doesn't necessarily mean that a person doesn't have a social circle. It's more about the quality of their relationship with others, isn't it?
It is, but here's a new fact that's not in the book because this research just came out. But interestingly, we used to think that loneliness was just a subjective feeling. You could be surrounded by people and still feel lonely, that it wasn't something that correlated with how much contact you have. But we're now learning that people who have less social contact, whether they feel lonely or not, still have a 30% reduced lifespan. They live, compared to their peers in a certain span of time, they live less long. So it's not so much your personal experience of whether you feel lonely, but really how much contact you have. So people who live alone, for example, which is, there's the highest rate of solo living now than ever in human history. It's increased about 300% in just about 40 years. Those people have a much reduced lifespan, whether or not they feel lonely, than people who live with others, whether it's family members or roommates. So interestingly, it's not just our approach to it, whether we feel good about being alone or not. It's really about the ping that little jolt that we get when we bump up against other people.
And have you found in all the research, and there's massive amounts of research in the book, that loneliness is particularly risky for women?
Yes, it is. And I might add that even though there is a lot of research in the book, Dave, it is a book about stories too.
Yeah.
So in particular, I went to Sardinia to investigate villages where men live as long as women, and which is quite unusual, and tell the stories there. And it's not just the women who connect, but the men who are surrounded, which is quite unusual. But getting back to your question about women, women tend to prioritize their relationships over their lives. And so the impact, for example, of a negative marriage is completely different for a woman than it is for a man. For a man, if he's married, whether it's a good marriage or a terrible marriage, he has a 250% increase in living longer than a man who's single or divorced. But for a woman, it's not the question of whether she's married that matters. It's whether she has a good marriage. And so that's really fascinating because social contact is a very shaded idea. It depends not only whether you're male or female, but on all sorts of other factors, such as your personality, how you use social contact, whether you have more weak contacts or more strong ones, or how you use your devices will really matter. For example, if you're really outgoing people tend to use their electronic devices to just engineer more get-togethers, to say, you know, meet me at this restaurant at this time, or, you know, let's have dinner at my house, or to find people who are like-minded for get-togethers, whereas introverted people, or say people on the autistic spectrum, often use their devices to replace real social contact.
I do want to go back to the Sardinian village in a second, but just before I do, I mean, we're talking here about something that isn't just musing on current problems that we all have. This is a serious, serious issue you're talking about, this village effect. And in fact, one of the things in the book here is just gives a quote from Christina Hoff Sommers, who's the author of Freedom, Feminism, Its Surprising History and Why It Matters Today. And she says, with a raft of surprising data, this compulsively readable, lively and meticulously researched book shows the direct and frequent human contact is at least as important to our survival as clean air or good nutrition. And is that one of the things you're trying to get across? And this is not just me telling you a few things. This is a problem that needs to be seriously addressed.
You hit the nail right on the head, actually, Dave, because the research tells us that if all the things that we can control, including whether we smoke or drink or are overweight or treat our heart condition or our hypertension, of anything that's within our control, social contact is the most predictive of how long we live. And this is really astounding to me. So one of the least predictive, for example, is the quality of the air we breathe. It's more important to have an integrated social network, meaning to get out there and meet people and participate in your community. It's more important than almost anything you can do, such as quitting your drinking habit or giving up smoking or going on a diet or getting a flu shot. This is really one of the most important things that we can do. And I think it's underrated. In other words, we used to really not think highly of people who spent a lot of time on the porch chatting. That was, you know, women's stuff, not important. You know, we would blow it off. But it's more important than almost anything. It's more important than going to the gym.
Yeah, or shooting the shit, as they call it here. Just having a good conversation, indeed. Yeah, okay. Now, listen, look, I mean, like, Susan, like, longevity is always evidence of happiness. We'll assume that for a second. If that's the case, tell me about the Sardinian village then, the features in the book, and its importance to the overall argument that you're making. Because almost everywhere in the world, men die an average of 5 to 7 years before women do. The one exception is this kind of a place in Sardinia. Tell me about that.
What was interesting there is that, yes, there are 10 times as many men who live to 100 and beyond there than there are in, you know, the UK or Canada or the United States. There are 6 times as many as on the Italian mainland, just 120 miles away. But the key here is not so much happiness. The key is being surrounded by people who care about you and respect you. So what's more common in our societies, and I'm including Canada as one of them, is that, you know, happiness is having a large, close-knit, loving family living in a distant village or a distant city. But what's more true there is people respect their elders. And as one researcher told me, that when you get old there, you're always surrounded by people with whom they love to natter. So, you know, when I came to interview these people, there was always a group of people in the kitchen or the living room. The neighbor was there. The barman, the person who, you know, served the drinks was there. Maybe the priest would drop in. There was usually one or two relatives, and they would kind of float in and out throughout the afternoon or morning while I was interviewing these folks. And what was important was that there wasn't one personality type. So it wasn't that, you know, one man, for example, was really grouchy and frankly irascible and unpleasant, but he was 102. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't his personality, I think, that helped him live a long life, but the fact that his niece and his grandniece were there to, take care of his physical needs and also to keep him company, to make him feel that he wasn't a solitary unit alone in the universe.
So longevity is less about the place necessarily than about who lives there and how they interact. You say we're more connected than ever and less connected than ever because of the internet. What exactly do you mean by that?
What I mean is that some of us have 300, 600, 800 Facebook friends, but we're getting a kind of very well-crafted advertisement when we connect with them on these social media. This is not the true person. You are connecting to a person who's presenting, putting their best foot forward, if you will. That's one aspect of it. And the other is that how many of those people would really be there for you if you needed help? The surveys tell us that we used to have at least three or more of these people a generation ago, and now we have two or fewer, and many people, especially men, have one, meaning their wives. Yeah. So if they lose their wives through divorce or illness or death, they have no one at all. And so it gives us the illusion of connectedness without giving us really the benefits of the real thing.
Yeah, of course. Does technology affect kids' happiness? And where would you say poverty comes in? I mean, surely poverty is also a major role in a child's development.
Yeah, well, what we're learning is that the amount of screen time increases as poverty and the child's disadvantaged situation increases.
Right.
And there are a lot of reasons for that. But it means that, for example, children who are left at home for long hours in front of a screen, or parents who believe that it's educational, and I might add there's no evidence for that, that your screens are educational, are really putting their children at a disadvantage. Whereas upper income parents realize that, no, you know, children have to play sports. They have to have time playing in the park with their friends. And there are more hands at home and more time at home, leisure time, to make that happen. So it's quite insidious in that, say, for example, new immigrants might think, you know, this is progress. Everybody has one of these. My child should have a tablet or a smartphone to fit in, when in reality, the unmonitored time is eroding their vocabularies, eroding their social skills. So I think that poverty does come into it in a very subtle way.
Yeah. And also one survey you found, like you say, toddlers who, like we're talking very, very young kids here, who watch more than 2 hours of TV a day, that they have shown to have behavioural problems at the age of five more so than those who don't.
Yes. And we don't really know that it's the screens that are causing this. And I make the point that it's not the screens per se, but what the screens are displacing. We do know, for example, there's a study where they strapped little tiny microphones on to toddlers and babies and just captured how much screen entertainment was in their environment. So it could have been programs directed to adults that are on the television or on the computer. It could be child-oriented entertainment. And they found a direct link, a direct correlation with the amount of screen entertainment and the level of that child's vocabulary. Mm. So the more minutes the child heard, and I'm talking about minutes now, of screen entertainment, the lower their vocabulary, to the degree that for every hour they heard, they had 500 fewer words when they started to talk. So it meant 500 fewer words that they were producing, but also there was less conversation from the parents. The parents' attention was not focused on the child, it was focused on the screen.
So bluntly, does each advance in technology just alienate our kids even further?
I'm not sure I would go that far, but I would say that it's something that we have to start talking about in the way that we only started talking about processed foods after they filled the shelves at Tesco and were starting to appear on our tables. We only started to talk about the impact of the car on our waistlines and our cities when it was too late. So I think it's really more, this book is not really a diatribe against technology, not at all, because technology is wonderful for all sorts of things. It's wonderful for establishing those weak connections. It's wonderful for making arrangements, for searching. It's a great dictionary. So it's great for lots of things, but it's not good for everything. So just as you wouldn't eat the same exact meal three times a day or for every snack because it provides the same calorie, neither should you connect the same way for everything. And what we're learning, for example, is in business, people who connect face to face, there's a 40% increase in the success in negotiation rates. At home, we were talking about family meals. When parents connect with their children, it boosts their vocabulary. That helps them be better readers in school. That helps them get into a better college. It helps them, for example, to have more teacher face to face time later as adolescents. So I think we're just underrating it because right now it seems invisible to us.
We all do it, even in terms of sending a text. It's so much easier sometimes to send a text than to have to do a kind of a thing called a conversation. It's just easier. It gets it across. So, like, I mean, we all fall for it sometimes. What can we do to increase, if you like, the meaningful personal relationships in our lives? I mean, how can we create this village in our own little worlds in order to gain the benefits of this thing called the village effect?
You are quite right that you don't need to live in a village to get the village effect. You can build it right where you live. And the first place to start is if you're moving to choose a neighborhood where people interact, because this can change from street to street. It's a place where there are what are called third places. These are cafes, park benches, community centers, libraries where people chat with each other. And, you know, for example, when I moved house a few years ago, I stopped people walking their dogs and said, do you know your neighbors? Do you talk to your neighbors? Because it's incredibly important for your happiness and your well-being and your longevity. At work, it's so much easier to send a text to the guy in the next cubicle or office or the woman down the hall. Get up and talk to them. You will have a more productive day, research shows, and you'll have closer bonds with your teammates. So, you know, fight against that urge to just spend your day texting and emailing, which I think is happening to a lot of us. Our work days are becoming so much more solitary. What's really important, too, is not to think of social bonds as just those few two or three people you feel close to, you know, your spouse, your best friend. You have to create a village of diverse relationships. So that means, believe it or not, joining things. You have to be part of a group or a club that meets regularly so that you have those weak bonds, and those people actually do protect your mental health and your physical health. So investing time in a kind of group activity mimics the kind of social interaction that comes naturally to those Sardinian villagers, right? They might not be best friends with the person who owns the grocery store, but the person who owns the grocery store still cares about that Sardinian centenarian, is bringing him fresh fruit and vegetables every few days. And finally, amplify your online contact with real contact. Use your devices to foster those face-to-face get-togethers at your neighbourhood.
Do you know, a funny thing is you've just said something there that there's a certain person in this organisation here. I won't mention who the person is, but I had to ask something. I went over to ask them that something about something to do with television here and blah, 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 blah. And they said, yeah, OK, send me an email. I said, no, I've just asked you. Are you stupid or something? Why do I need to send you an email? The answer is yes or no. It's pretty good, I must say. So I came all the way over to you. Anyway, you're right. Susan Pinker, listen, thank you very much indeed for talking to us. Author of The Sexual Paradox, but we're talking here about the Village Effect, Why Face-to-Face Contact Matters, and it's Atlantic Books is the publisher. And just one last thing, just want to say congratulations, because we know the hornet's nest is there and you've opened it. Thanks very much, Susan.
Thank you, Dave.